Hello, and welcome to The Right to Be Heard, the Columbia Law Review podcast. I'm Kristen Popham, your host for today's episode. Thank you for listening. I am here today with Etienne Toussaint, Associate Professor of Law at the University of South Carolina, Joseph F. Rice School of Law. Professor Toussaint studies the historical development of poverty, food insecurity, and environmental injustice in the U.S. political economy. His scholarship draws on critical legal theory, examining the relationship among race, culture, and modern social movements as they confront private law's ordering of the U.S. economy. Professor Toussaint has been widely recognized for his teaching and his scholarship, earning the National Bar Association's 40 Under 40 Award in 2024, among many other awards, for his extraordinary contributions to the field. One of Professor Toussaint's recent publications was featured in Columbia Law Review. The piece, entitled On the Cultivation of Black Letter Law, explores the ways we must intentionally read culture and engage with the sociological dimensions of race and racism to gain deeper insights into the essential nature of law itself. We are very lucky to have Professor Toussaint with us today to dive deeper into that piece. Thank you so much for being here, Professor. So in contemplating how to begin this conversation, I was brought back repeatedly to how you began your piece with the story of Nolan Brown, which struck me as the only possible place for us to begin today. I was hoping I could start by asking you to read an excerpt of from your piece on the cultivation of black letter law on Nolan Brown, and then tell us a little bit about Nolan and how the narrative shaped your piece for the Columbia Law Review.
Sure. And thank you so much for the invitation. Thank you for the opportunity to be here and share a little bit about this piece with you. So let me begin with the introduction. I could begin by telling you about Nolan Brown. For starters, if Nolan and I were to get into a fight, it would be him, hard shoulders inching toward 6 feet tall above basketball-sized hands, against me, a pudgy 5'5" with Harry Potter frames and a sagging JanSport book bag full of textbooks. He would throw hands like a youthful Mike Tyson, and I would duck and weave on the cracked asphalt like an aging Muhammad Ali, dancing clumsily while admiring his gleaming Nike Air Jordan sneakers and oversized Rockaway jeans, each making far more of a fashion statement beside my creased Nike Air Force Ones and weathered green cargo pants. Smirking, Nolan would smack my bicep until its caramel hue matched his dark brown sheen, and I would eventually give in, as I so often did, because hanging out with Nolan Brown was kind of a big deal. I might proceed by explaining why a 13-year-old boy found joy in the routine submission of feeble arms to clenched fists, why he found comfort in the violent embrace of a heavy hand after that familiar yet mundane question mediating almost every encounter in this part of the hood, what's good? Yes, Nolan was physically big. Even while running from the Latina girls at recess with a stolen hair clip and a mischievous wink, even while caged in the solitary desk in the back of Mr. Miller's seventh grade classroom with a paper plane and a defiant smirk, even while pocketing his detention slip like a cowboy sliding his gun into the holster, even while standing in the hallway where our mostly white teachers sent their disruptive black and Latinx students, Nolan's outsized stature was forever at ease. But more than that, Nolan was the kind of kid every black boy in the South Bronx wanted to become, including me. He was kind of a big deal. Bigger than Michael Jordan when he dunked from the free throw line in the 1998 slam dunk contest to defeat Dominique Wilkins. Maybe even bigger than B.I.G.'s Life After Death when the album dropped almost 10 years later in March 1997. Witty shooter in class, sharp shooter on the court, straight shooter around the block, even the boys in eighth grade greeted Nolan with respect. Beginning with Nolan might clarify how the concept of a person racialized as black, one who embodies a trend-setting popular culture celebrated by mass media, highlights the paradoxical nature of law in a society shaped by a liberal capitalist economy a constitutional Republican government, and a long history of legally sanctioned racial injustice.
Thank you so much. Could you tell us a little bit about why you began your piece with Nolan Brown?
So Nolan Brown is a pseudonym for one of my best friends growing up in the South Bronx in New York City. We lived about four doors away from one another. We went to the same elementary school. And what was fascinating to me as I reflected upon my experience growing up in this urban context is the way that we were perceived very differently by those in positions of authority in our lives. You know, most specifically in this piece, I discuss those in our elementary school and how that shaped our trajectory when it comes to where those authority figures pushed us in different directions. You know, both Nolan and I were good students, but he was the stereotypical class clown. And it was very interesting to think about how a culture of orderly behavior, a culture of the rule of law as it manifests in the elementary school context, shaped how we were guided through the educational system. And in this particular piece, one of the themes that I'm trying to think through is that relationship between law and culture, and how cultural ideas of what it means to be a human and interact with other people in cities shapes our conceptions of what types of behaviors are good, what types of behaviors are bad, and how that impacts our different lived experiences. So I wanted to start with that relationship with Nolan, who's someone that I deeply admired, but the cultural context that we found ourselves within, I think, pushed us in different directions. And of course, I will say the real person that Nolan is based upon went on to have a very successful career being involved in local government and doing a lot of meaningful work that's very impactful in the community. But I think we both experienced growing up in this dynamic in different ways, even though we were best friends, because of our relationship with these cultural expectations and stereotypes that framed how people interacted with us, how they responded to our behavior in these contexts, and the assumptions that they made about what that meant, about who we were as individuals.
Thank you for that. I know as you're describing your piece's inclusion of firsthand accounts that sort of personify the very narrative of law and culture's relationship feeds into your argument that that relationship exists and cultivates it in your piece itself. Now, I remember when we first discussed your piece a while back, I admittedly new to the world of legal scholarship called your lens radical. And I remember very clearly that you pushed back on the notion of radicality, or that it should be radical. So what is it about the way that we've defined law and legal scholarship that makes this seem atypical inside the law school, but commonplace outside of it? And why do you push back on the notion that this lens is radical?
I appreciate that question because it gets at something important about the methodological traditions in legal scholarship. When I pushed back on the characterization of my approach in this piece as radical, it wasn't to necessarily dismiss your observation that this style of writing differs from traditional legal scholarship. It absolutely does. What I wanted to highlight is that using personal narrative and cultural experience to understanding law isn't actually new or revolutionary. It's just something that's been happening, ironically, outside of the walls of law schools. In fields like cultural studies, sociology, literary theory, and of course, critical race theory, scholars have been examining the relationship between lived experience and legal structures for decades. Folks like Kimberly Crenshaw, Patricia Williams, and Derek Bell, all of those scholars have been using narrative and cultural analysis for decades to illuminate how law operates in racialized communities since at least the 1980s. And of course, there's a Black radical tradition that dates back to the earliest decades of our country's founding, where intellectuals utilize their own personal experience, their own personal narrative. Think of the autobiographies of people like Frederick Douglass to reflect upon their experience, their lived experience of the law that shaped their everyday lives. What makes this approach, I think, atypical within law schools is the persistence of a tradition that treats law as something that can be studied in isolation from culture and lived experience, as though legal doctrine exists in some pure objective realm. And without making a pun of the words, I think that's a fiction. My story about Nolan Brown isn't just a literary device. It's a concrete illustration of how legal concepts like disorderly conduct or chronic misbehavior are culturally applied to certain groups, in this particular context, the Black boys. And that's not radical, it's an observable reality. If anything is truly radical, it's the artificial separation of law from culture and lived experience, a separation that privileges certain perspectives, certain experiences, while marginalizing others. When we examine how law actually operates in communities like the South Bronx, we see that cultural narratives around Black masculinity, around the workplace, around success and merit, directly influence how legal rules are interpreted and applied. And therefore, I think it's necessary that if we want to understand law's true operation in society and law's true meaning, we need to integrate a conversation about culture and lived experience. I think what made me push back to kind of fully answer the question is that labeling this approach radical risks positioning it as peripheral or optional to legal scholarship, when I believe it's actually essential to a complete understanding of law, particularly for communities whose experiences have often been excluded from traditional legal analysis. It's not radical to include this experience in our understanding of law. I think what's radical is continuing to exclude it.
That's beautifully put. I wanted to share that I, since our conversation, ended up writing a little bit of legal scholarship myself for my note about the intersection of disability. So I'm a disabled woman, and I ended up including firsthand accounts. But through the process of publication and advising, was told a lot of times, like, you're taking a risk. And I remembered having the tools and the vocabulary to push back against the notion of risk because of our conversation. So I wanted to thank you for that and for what you're contributing. So what motivated you to start thinking about law and legal scholarship in this way, pushing back against this pseudo-objective lens cultivated by legal scholars?
Yeah. So first, let me applaud you. And I'm deeply honored and humbled that my scholarship was able to inspire you in that way. And I look forward to reading that piece. I think it's so important, especially when you're talking about topics like disability law, to bring in that lived experience to help us wrestle with the gaps in the law and to help us understand how we bring those experiences to our interpretation of what the law means. I started thinking about law and legal scholarship in this way because of the fundamental tension I saw between the legal academy's claims to objectivity and the reality that law at its core, in my view, is a cultural and political practice. Growing up, I saw firsthand how legal rules functioned very differently depending on who you were and where you lived. But in law school, I was taught, like we all are, to read cases as if they spoke in a singular, neutral voice, one that supposedly transcended history, race, and power. And the more I studied these cases, the more I continued to ask myself, what about the culture that this fact pattern exists within? What about the gender dynamics at play? What about the racial dynamics at play? The class distinctions, the political differences among the judges? The more I recognized that this so-called neutrality was itself a constructed narrative, one that privileges certain perspectives and certain viewpoints while marginalizing others, or at least that's often the risk. This realization brought me back to an older debate within the law and literature movement, the question of whether legal text, like literary text, are subject to indeterminate interpretation or whether they possess fixed objective meaning. And there have been scholars in the law and literature movement, like Stanley Fish and Sanford Levinson, that challenged the notion that meaning in literature, and by extension law, was ever stable or determinate, arguing that interpretation is always shaped by the values and interests of the interpreter. In addition, other legal scholars like Robin West pushed back on that notion, suggesting that legal texts differ from literary texts because they impose certain constraints through the nature of adjudication and society's shared moral expectations. And so there was a bit of a divide as I delved into this scholarship in the law and literature movement about the ability to bring forward literary analytical tools into our study and exploration of law. A divide between a subjectivist view that all interpretation is an act of power and an objectivist view that legal meaning can be fixed through reason constraints. And I believe that debate has not only never been fully resolved, but we've missed out on an opportunity in recent decades to engage literature across a spectrum of cultures to help us make sense of the ongoing tensions and challenges that we see in our society today. And so my work re-engages this law and literature debate by interrogating how legal meaning is constructed, not just in courtrooms and not just in law school classrooms, but in cultural spaces where law is contested and redefined. I argue that both sides of the older debate is missing something very crucial. The subjectivists are right to say that interpretation is an act of power, but their critique risks slipping into nihilism, making it difficult to advocate for justice within law because it's unclear what we should decide the law actually means. Meanwhile, the objectivists are correct that the law does have unique interpretive constraints that govern our interpretation of what it means, but they also fail to acknowledge that those constraints are shaped by dominant cultural narratives, narratives that often reinforce racial and economic hierarchies. So rather than accept this binary, I return to literature and cultural expression, especially Black literature, as a means of seeing how law operates beyond the narrow frames of judicial interpretation. And so therefore my work looks at how legal meaning emerges in unexpected places, in hip-hop lyrics, in the coded language of marginalized communities, in the way that people navigate systems of surveillance, systems of exclusion, systems of disability law, and as you are doing, right? And so by doing so, I push the law and literature conversation forward, showing how cultural expressions serve as both a critique of legal meaning and a space where new legal imaginaries can emerge.
As you're describing it, I realize that my next question you've mostly answered, but I wanted to understand your argument a little bit more. You say, quote, from a literary standpoint, reading Black American culture alongside law, the study of law and culture reveals unique insights about the nature of law, from how it's formed to how it's perceived, received, and enforced in everyday life, including when it contradicts its stated aims, end quote. I was wondering if you could tell us what you mean by this, but if you feel like you've captured it, that's okay.
Yeah, so when I say that reading Black American culture alongside law reveals unique insights about the nature of law, I mean that law is not merely a system of rules enforced by courts, but also a living, breathing cultural force, one that is shaped by and interacts with the everyday lives of people, often in ways that contradict its stated aims. Legal scholars tend to analyze law as though it exists in isolation, governed by doctrines, statutes, and judicial decisions. But when we turn to Black cultural production, from literature to music, oral traditions, and other forms of expression, we see that law operates in a much more dynamic and contested space. And this conversation in this article is building upon work that legal scholar Robin West has engaged in recent decades, where she's trying to wrestle with the questions around cultural legal studies and what we can learn about law by exploring culture. And she does so by drawing parallels between cultural legal studies and the law and literature movement. And there are two important insights that she mentions that I want to highlight, that I note in this piece, that I think are important to understand what I'm contributing when I say read Black American culture. So first, she notes that the law and literature movement pursued a literary project, which recognizes that literature often engages with law as its subject and provides insights that law itself, empirical social science, or even analytical philosophy cannot offer. In other words, the literature is helping us to better understand what law means. And similarly, there are cultural works that address legal themes, both explicitly and implicitly. We could think about music as one example, that can deepen our understanding of formal law and reveal to us how these laws are disseminated, how they're perceived, and how they are received among various social groups. So that's a sort of literary project. Secondly, the law and literature movement, as Robin West explains, engaged in what is called a jurisprudential project, which asserts that literature, both historically and contemporary society, retains a force of law, and therefore literature can comprise part of what one might call the informal or vernacular aspects of law. And so in that regard, what we're trying to acknowledge is that literary and legal text can possess legal power to define, generate, and preserve, as well as reflect shared community values. Right, think about the movie Birth of a Nation in the beginning of the 20th century and how that cultural view of race had a kind of legal power by legitimizing the Jim Crow regime that was emerging across the United States. And so similarly, these cultural practices can embody the political and normative force of legal authority. And this very much conveys a sense of law as culture or culture as law, which is something that legal scholar at Georgetown, Naomi Mezzi, has said. Third, Robin West urges us to think about the law and literature movement as pursuing a hermeneutic project. And this gets a little bit deeper into textual analysis. So this recognizes that both genres, law and literature, stem from the world of text, right? To be interpreted text. And traditionally, scholars have sought to discern an author's intention in drafting a text under a theory that the text contains one meaning. And so this is where the law and literature movement kind of merged with questions that constitutional scholars were having in the late 20th century about how do we interpret the meaning of a legal text. And we're still having that conversation today when we think about debates between originalists and others, right? Living constitutionalists. And let me add a little bit more insight that'll allow me to come full circle to what I mean by reading Black culture alongside law. So traditionally, scholars have sought to discern an author's intention in drafting a text under a theory that the text contains one meaning. Structuralists emerge in the late 20th century, and they argue that we can derive meaning from the text structure itself. Post-structuralists view meaning as a product of a dynamic interaction between the reader and the text itself. So the reader is bringing in their own personal biases and views into the text, and we should take that into account when we're thinking about the meaning of the text. And building upon that, deconstructionism emerges in the late 20th century, specifically the 1970s and 1980s, as a method of textual interpretation. Largely outside of the law school context, but legal scholars are bringing in methods of deconstructionism into their scholarship. And what they're arguing is that the meaning of a text emerges through an analysis of what is absent or repressed in the text. And so they want to deconstruct the text, break it up into its component parts, and try to understand what ideas, what values, what principles are embedded within the text, even though they're not explicitly stated. And this was important because this allowed advocates for legal reform to begin looking at legal text and trying to articulate meanings and applications of the text in terms of how it impacted different groups, but wasn't explicitly stated, right? This relates to this concept of unconscious ideas embedded in the text, unconscious biases and structural ideologies that are embedded in text, even though they're not explicitly stated. And so they challenge the normative assumptions that we believe the text reflects and try to expose the way the text privileges certain social theories, certain interpretations of human nature. And so this is can be described as a hermeneutic project. It's trying to use literary and analytical techniques to extract meaning from the text. But here's where my piece sort of brings in something new. Robin West argues that while we can read literature for its substantive contributions to our understanding of law, there's no analogous approach for cultural legal studies scholars. In other words, she suggests that we haven't yet developed a method to read culture to enrich our understanding of law. Or at least there's been no systematic treatment, she says, of the possibility that cultural products might actually contain insights into the nature of law, into how we should interpret law, and guide us in thinking about jurisprudential debates. And so whereas Naomi Mezzi urged us to think about law as culture or culture as law, what I'm urging us to consider is a sense of law in culture and a sense of culture in law. And so then to come back full circle, when we turn back to Black cultural production, literature, music, and other forms of expression, my argument is that we can begin to see how law operates in a more dynamic and contested space by reading cultural expressions of democratic life to understand and interpret the meaning of legal text. And if you would allow me, let me just share some examples. So take, for example, the way Black writers and artists have long interrogated the promises of law versus its realities. Figures like Toni Morrison and James Baldwin have used literature to expose the cultural contradictions between law's professed commitments to justice and the way it enforces a racialized inequality in modern society. For example, in Toni Morrison's book, Beloved, she shows how the Fugitive Slave Act turned law into a tool of terror, and the cultural practices that are adopted in Black communities to try to reckon with the meaning of that law. And it forces us to question what concepts like justice means, even when legal regimes themselves are complicit in that oppression. And so these literary works do more than critique the legal doctrine. They actually reveal how the law is experienced, how it shapes identities, how communities navigate its failures, and then ultimately what the law actually means, what the text actually means as it is interpreted by the readers of the text. And I'm using the word there, read, in a capacious way, right? We're reading the legal text through our lived experience of it. And so therefore, reading Black American culture alongside law shifts our focus. It's not just about whether law can be read like literature. It's about how literature and cultural narratives reveals the limits of law's claimed objectivity. So literature and cultural narratives actually teach us what the law is in ways that sitting in law school classrooms and reading legal cases, we don't fully grasp the meaning of the law that emerges from that cultural expression.
As a law student right now, listening to what you're saying, I'm struck by, one, the dominance of the theory that there is one objective meaning to text right now, which is dominating both jurisprudence, constitutional jurisprudence, but also dominating law school classrooms in some way, the need to at least respect and understand that theory behind reading the law. So I love hearing how your project displaces or destabilizes that presumption. And I look forward to seeing how, I think you should teach judges is what I'm realizing. I'm like, so the judges need to sit down in this type of environment and learn how to read law in this way. But it also makes me realize that lawyers aren't necessarily being trained in that way. So it's a critical project.
Yeah, I think it also reminds us that in law school and in practice, lawyers are often taught to regard themselves as the sage on the stage, the protectors of the rule of law, and the only people in our society that are entitled to discuss the law, to interpret the law, to think about what the law means. But I think if we really embrace the true meaning of democracy, which is a kind of society where all people are empowered to engage in political discourse, to engage in debate about how their lived experiences are shaped by the laws and policies that govern their lives, then in fact, we should be more willing to embrace different articulations of what the law means, different articulations of where the law should go. And that's not only reflected in the legal opinions of judges or the legal scholarship of lawyers, but it's also reflected in the cultural products of artists, of writers, of musicians, and then also just the everyday conversation of citizens around the country, conversations in barbershops and hair salons, in the aisles of Whole Foods, of Publix, right? People are having conversations about what the law means. And I think that's a true democracy when you create an atmosphere where the Constitution, right, is not, and this is maybe me adding a little bit of my own personal view, right? What is the Constitution? The Constitution is not beholden to a fixed meaning that is enshrined during an era of our country's founding that we venerate and hold in high regard as if it were a kind of divine force, right? And there are reasons why that paradigm exists, but that we think about the Constitution as a body of principles that describes how we as citizens choose to constitute ourselves around one another and among one another in communities. And the way that we choose to constitute ourselves evolves, right? The way that we choose to love and protect and engage with one another, the way that we choose to recognize one another, to recognize the dignity of people around our country over time evolves as we better understand who we are. And so therefore our Constitution should evolve and our interpretation of what the Constitution means should evolve to reflect our evolving understanding of what it means to constitute one another in a community in love, right? We see same-sex couples, right? We have an evolving understanding of what it means to constitute ourselves in a community where we can embrace and love and dignify those types of relationships.
And what you're describing is a so much more democratic project, a project that embodies and personifies the democratic ideals at the foundation of that text. So I appreciate that perspective. Your piece also there speaks a lot about the weaponization of culture in politics, which I wanted to get to, because you mentioned that, quote, the impact of culture on the law depends on how those in power choose to wield it, end quote. That statement struck me as especially salient in the months since your piece was even published. So I was wondering if you could explain a little bit about what you mean by the weaponization of culture in politics and how we see that today.
The weaponization of culture in politics refers to the ways in which those in power often strategically deploy cultural narratives, symbols, and rituals to legitimize legal regimes, to justify policy decisions, and to shape public perceptions of social and economic conditions, right? And often to normalize the things around us that, you know, on an instinctual level, we feel like something's wrong. And so culture in this sense is not merely an expression of shared values or traditions. It becomes an active tool used by those in power to sustain, or in some instances, to challenge existing institutional structures. In the piece, I argue that the impact of culture on the law depends on how it is wielded by those in positions of authority. And I think this is evident in a lot of cultural practices. For example, we could think about the Pledge of Allegiance, which, as I describe in the piece, functions as more than just a patriotic exercise. One can think about it as a daily ritual that instills beliefs in the American legal order, reinforcing the idea that the nation's founding ideals, liberty, justice, and equality, are intact, even though the lived realities of marginalized communities might suggest otherwise. So one might view this cultural practice as a form of ideological reinforcement, right? Even though, to be sure, the Pledge of Allegiance calls us to the better of our angels, but in some regard, it also can legitimize the existing status quo, not through statutes, not through judicial rulings, but through this everyday cultural practice that defines how people relate to the legal system. And that's just one example that maybe many listeners can identify with. I think more broadly across history, political leaders have long weaponized culture to serve legal and economic ends. And perhaps the classic example is President Ronald Reagan's use of the welfare queen trope in the 1980s, right? Rather than confronting the structural causes of poverty that were destroying urban communities during that time and calling into question the extent to which the social welfare state needed to be expanded or needed to be reformed to better address those issues, right? Rather than thinking about the disinvestment in public housing, declining wages, the racialized exclusion of certain groups from social benefits, Reagan invokes a cultural caricature of Black women as deceitful, as undeserving of trying to get a handout, as a way to shape the evolution of law and policy. And so this narrative lays the groundwork for legal and policy challenges, including welfare cuts, and, as we all know, the rise of punitive policing in low-income communities. And so it shifts the public's attention away from the state's role in producing, or at least reinforcing, systems of economic inequality. And culture becomes a political weapon used to justify these legal and policy decisions that are leading to harm. And this dynamic continues to persist in our modern day, right? As you mentioned, in recent months, we've seen political leaders weaponize cultural debates around education, around gender, and around race and our history of race relations in our country to push specific legal agendas, right? Book bans are targeting works by Black and LGBTQ plus authors, for instance. And they're not just cultural disputes over what students should read, they become legal maneuvers designed to control public narratives around history, around race, around identity, around what is appropriate and what is disorderly conduct, right? So by reframing book bans as necessary for parents to protect their culture, their cultural preferences, lawmakers obscure the fact that these policies are part of a broader effort to suppress dissenting voices, to erase marginalized histories, and to limit the education that students have in the school setting, right? And so therefore to contain and constrain the ability for students to have democratic debates about how best to live together in a society. And finally, I do have to note that attacks on diversity, equity, and inclusion are similarly being framed as necessary correctives to a woke culture. So again, this is an effort to weaponize a conversation about wokeness as a cultural practice, and we can have a much deeper conversation about what that even means to frame the concept of wokeness as a kind of culture, but they serve a legal function, as we've all seen, right? Dismantling laws and policies that historically were designed to address racial and gender and other kinds of disparities that were the legacy of the Jim Crow era, right? When these policies arrived. And so here again, culture is not incidental, but culture is central to how the law operates. And political actors are leveraging these cultural ideas, these cultural anxieties, these cultural fears to roll back civil rights protections and to present legal reforms as responses to a cultural crisis rather than deliberate policy choices that are reinforcing existing hierarchies and embracing certain narratives about what it means to be an American in our society today, what it means to make America great again.
It's so interesting to hear you describe what sounds like the reliance on culture of law by many people thinking about and shaping the law. But it seems to me like those very same people who are relying on and deploying the law, deploying culture and weaponizing culture in this way, on the back end, seem to try and divorce the very inextricability of law and culture. They try to, it seems like they are also, these thinkers try to treat law as something in this totally separate objective sphere when they come back to interpreting it. So the irony of what you're describing is so salient and interesting to me.
Yeah, there's a clear cognitive dissonance, and it's difficult for one to fully understand why it exists and persists without a robust understanding of our country's legal history. You know, and unfortunately, efforts to attack our study of history, I think, are efforts to shape the narrative and to make it difficult for people to have that deeper understanding of the way that culture is being weaponized. Because to be sure, if we go back and, you know, I won't, for the sake of time, provide this dissertation, but if we go back to the very founding of our country and think about the cultivation of black letter law, right? That occurred in the context of cultural debates about what it means to be free when one divorces their community from a monarchy, right? What it means to live in a democracy as a citizen when one lives in a political economy structured by capitalist systems and systems of private property that result in the consolidation of wealth among some and the perpetuation of poverty among many, right? There were a lot of cultural debates that shaped the evolution of law from our country's founding. Debates about whether citizens should be given land by the government, right? And we can see how that results in laws like the Homestead Act, but also questions about who deserves that land. And so one can see the original Homestead Act is not afforded to Black Americans. And also who is allowed to engage in political discourse in the context of voting, right? And that is related to cultural conversations about the relationship between men and women and the appropriate role that they should serve in society. And so that then impacts debates about voting and voting rights and how that has shifted over time. And of course, voting rights laws have not only been merely about race. One could go back all the way to the antebellum era where there were debates about class. Must one own property? Must one have a certain level of stature or income in the society before they can engage in voting? And this is a question about what it means to engage in political discourse. That's a cultural conversation. And finally, you know, one could think about the workplace itself and the cultures that have developed in the workplace that in many ways are a continuation of cultures that developed during the antebellum era, right? What are the rights of workers in relation to the owners of capital, the employers? What ability should workers have to work collectively and develop collective power in opposition to the owners of capital? What relationship should the owners of capital have with politics, right? We think about lobbying. We think about the political power of corporations as a modern, as a modern idea, as a modern manifestation. But it goes all the way back to the beginning of our country and the immense power that the wealthy had to shape the evolution of politics. Obviously, and then law follows. You could look at the robber barons and the owners of industry as the Industrial Revolution was evolving in the early 20th century and how that shapes the evolution of a variety of laws and policies. And one of the first articles I wrote, and I'll end here, is an article I wrote for the Houston Law Review called The New Gospel of Wealth. In that piece, I was reflecting on impact investing, but I mention it because the title of the piece is an allusion to an essay written by Andrew Carnegie in the early 20th century called The Gospel of Wealth. And that article, or essay rather, was his sort of opinion editorial about why the wealthy in society should be given the power to control decision-making, or at least influence decision-making in ways, because they're better suited, right? So it's a very elitist sort of framing of endorsing the concentration of immense wealth, which he had, in the hands of a few. So throughout American history, questions of culture, what it means to be a citizen, what democracy means, what rights different groups should have, what it means to have a sense of order, disorder, how we should structure our workplace, right? What should be defined as the private sector? What should be defined as public? What should be defined as the home? What should be defined as the work? All of these things have in many ways been shaped by cultural conversations. So this is not something new, but those in power are sort of manipulating the narrative to shape the conversations that we're having about the legitimacy of the laws and policies that are emerging.
It's fascinating to see all of the examples over time that you've laid out. Thank you so much, Professor Toussaint. This has been such a generative conversation. I have one last kind of impossible question, which is, if there's one thing that you'd want readers and listeners to take away from your contributions, what do you think that would be?
Thank you so much for ending with this question. If there's one thing I want readers and listeners to take away from my contributions to legal scholarship, from the style of writing that I try to showcase in the work that I do, it is that law is never neutral. Law is shaped by culture, and in turn, it shapes the way we understand power, the way we understand justice, and the way that we understand democracy. Too often, legal discourse and legal scholarship presents law as a detached, objective system, as though it exists outside of the social and historical forces that produce it, right? We still often refer to the conversation between law and society as a conversation between two different paradigms. But my work argues that law is not just written in statutes or decided in courtrooms. The law is lived, right? It's contested, and it's often wielded as a tool of both oppression and liberation. And so by examining how cultural practices, which spans the gamut from literature to music to the everyday patterns of living that we see across a wide spectrum of communities, by examining that alongside a study of law, I think I want people to see that legal reform and legal transformation is not just about reforming institutions, but it's about shifting the narratives, the cultural narratives that are embedded within those institutions and that sustain them. The way that we talk about crime, the way that we talk about poverty, the way that we talk about race and racism, and the way that we talk about democracy matters, because those narratives will influence policy choices, they will influence judicial reasoning, and they will influence public perceptions about the legitimacy or illegitimacy about certain conversations about the law. And so therefore, the struggle for justice is not just about writing better laws, it's about reimagining the cultural conversations that we have that determine whose experiences and whose histories are recognized as legitimate, as recognized as voices that should be heard in the halls of legal debate, and whose suffering is seen as tolerable and therefore unnecessary for us to regard. And here I'm always reminded of my experience when I was teaching in Washington, D.C. It was heartbreaking because every time I left the metro and would walk toward the law school building, I would pass an encampment of unhoused people. And it always reminded me of the people who live around us whose injustices become normalized. They become part of the landscape. And so therefore, their voices aren't always brought into the conversations about what law means and how law should be reformed. I think if we begin to understand law in this way, then the fight for justice requires not only legal expertise, but also cultural expertise and cultural critique, right? What some scholars call cultural competency. It means that recognizing that the law is always political and that legal decisions therefore reflect deeper historical ideological battles, and that when real change happens, we challenge not only legal and cultural structures, but we're challenging the kinds of conversations that we have that sustain the inequalities that we see all around. So in short, ultimately, I hope that my work helps a wide variety of people, whether it's scholars, activists, or students, or anyone engaged in struggles for justice, to see law, and most importantly, to see their own voice and their own cultural experiences as a dynamic force that can be used for good to help change the trajectory of law and reimagine what our, as Martin Luther King put it, beloved community can look like.
Thank you so much, Professor, for your extremely thoughtful words today and for bringing to life a piece of scholarship that is already bleeding with life. So thank you so much for taking the time, and I look forward to seeing your name in all of the contributions to the future that you're going to offer the legal field. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you to the Columbia Law Review for all the wonderful work that you all are doing.